You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning and welcome to the Carnegie Endowment on this beautiful Monday morning. Thank you for coming. We have an apology and we hope to be able to solve the problem soon. We don't have a participants list. The printer is acting up. So we hope that we'll be able to distribute them later during the meeting. I don't think I have to give a long introduction about the importance of this topic, about the Saudi counterterrorism strategy, or soft counterterrorism strategy, as the title of the talks indicates. I think this is an issue that is attracting an increasing amount of attention around the world, both on the part of counterterrorism agencies everywhere, because as you all know very well, the issue of how to deal with suspects, people who have been released, people, is becoming increasingly complicated. You just need to see what is happening with, for example, trials of some of the Guantanamo prisoners, what happens to the Guantanamo prisoners once they are released to their countries, so that there is an enormous amount of interest in this topic. We are lucky to have two very good speakers with us. The first one is Christopher Busek, if I have pronounced your name right, I'm finally learning, who has recently joined the Carnegie Endowment, and he's working on this issue, but more broadly on security issues concerning the Gulf. He worked in the past at the United Services Institute for Defense and Security Studies in London, and he was a postdoc at Princeton University just before he came here. The paper that he has written on this topic is being released now. I hope that you were able to pick up a copy, and in any case, it is posted on our website. To act as a discussant, we have Ambassador Daly, who is the Department of State's Coordinator for Counterterrorism, and of course, he will be he's in a perfect position to discuss the issue in the State Department's view. I'm not going to go into the details about the bios. They are lengthy, and you have copies of them in any case. So without further ado, Chris.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you all for starting out your week coming here to listen to me talk about Saudi Arabia and terrorism and rehabilitation and things like that. I think what I'll plan to do is I'll speak for about 15 minutes and kind of give an overview of the paper and what the Saudi government is trying to do. And then hopefully, especially because this is a nice sized group, that we can have a discussion, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions. So I think I'll start out just by saying that the way that the Saudis are now looking at counterterrorism, especially these soft measures, and we could talk later about the hard law enforcement and security type things that the Saudis have done, but all of these soft counterterrorism efforts are designed in part to combat the intellectual and the ideological justifications for violent extremism inside Saudi Arabia. So the way the Saudis look at this is it's a three-part strategy. There are prevention programs to keep you from getting into trouble in the first place. There are rehabilitation programs to take care of you once you're in the government's care, once you're in prison. And then there are aftercare programs to facilitate your reintegration back into society. And everything that the Saudis do in terms of fighting terrorism involve three different factors. There's money, there's force, and there's religious ideology. So the things that we'll be talking about today mostly involve religious ideology and a whole lot of money. And I think that's a really important thing to stress right at the outset, that the reason why the Saudis have been able to do what they've been able to do is because the Ministry of Interior has been given a blank check. And you can see that this isn't just paying for cars or paying for weddings and things like that that often get written about in the press. It involves very large capital expenditures, new prisons, new rehabilitation facilities, which I'll get into in more detail. So prevention programs, there are things that get done through different ministries within the government. The strategy is all coordinated through the Ministry of Interior, and the Ministry of Interior then says to other ministries, what could you be doing to help fight extremism or help combat terrorism? So if the Ministry of Education does a program, they might turn around and say to the Ministry of Culture, how could you contribute? And the way the Ministry of Interior looks at this is they provide speakers, materials, books, ideas, things like that to help different ministries put different programs together. So, for instance, the Ministry of Education has programs in Saudi schools. And just about every week, there's a different program, a week-long program that starts, which will be tailored around a theme. So it might be what are the effects of terrorism on our country, or how could we increase nationalism, or how does extremism affect society? And through these programs, there will be essay contests, there will be art contests where children are encouraged to get active thinking about these things, and there are prizes and stuff awarded to help encourage others to participate. There are also efforts to eliminate some of the opportunities where school children might have been exposed to extremist ideologies. So in the past, they've seen that it's been times when school kids aren't in school or when instructors go off message. So there have been programs to create summer camps, to create other types of activities like 4x4 racing or camel racing or other things to keep kids busy. So when they're not in school during term time, they're doing things instead of getting mixed up with extremists. Also, then the Ministry of Education will produce books and pamphlets and things like that that get passed out through the school. Children take these books home, and then they share them once they get home. And the research shows that, typically about 5 other people read the books that get brought home through schools. A few words about what goes on in the Ministry of Islamic Affairs. There are programs, and these are structured around mosques. Because one of the things that the organizers of this campaign have found out is that the best way to reach young Saudi men is through Friday prayers. So there are messages delivered at mosque. There are study circles organized. There are lectures and other evening activities set up. The Ministry of Islamic Affairs also does a program with the Ministry of Interior, sort of as an NGO program designed to combat internet radicalization. And this is where Islamic scholars go online to dialogue with people who would be looking for religious knowledge through the internet. What they do is they'll find people online who are asking questions. Religious scholars then engage them and try to demonstrate that what it was they were thinking or what it was they were trying to learn more about is based on a corrupted understanding of Islam. So that's real quick about prevention programs, and we can talk more about that during the Q&A. There's also a very sophisticated information campaign, and this involves messaging at ATM machines, at billboards, big signs hung from flyovers. There's also a series of television programs that have been produced. One of them was a show about a guy who gets mixed up with extremists. They want him to be involved in a suicide attack. He realizes this is what he wants to do, and they remotely detonate him. He survives the attack, ends up terribly disfigured, and the moral of the story is it's not just you that suffers, it's your family and everyone else, with very obvious parallels to the Ahmad Ashaya case, the guy that was involved in the bombing of the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad. So I'll say a few words about rehab. And rehabilitation is probably the aspect that's best known of all these programs. And this is an attempt to engage security prisoners, so people who get arrested inside the kingdom for domestic security offenses. There are also people who go through this program that have either tried to go to Iraq and been captured, or people who come back from Iraq. And there's also a program to deal with guys that come back from Guantanamo Bay. So through this program, the religious scholars, so it could be university professors, it could be imams, sheikhs, things like that, and sit down and talk with people in prison, ask them how they came to be in this position, and try to get them to talk about what it was that they were using to justify their beliefs or their actions. Through dialogue, then the sheikhs try to teach them that, you know, this is based on a corrupted understanding of Islam, and they try to guide them back to the right path. And there are a couple of important things to note about this approach. The first is that if you, according to the Saudi government, if you have blood on your hands, if you've been involved in violence domestically, you can't get out of prison through this program. If you still have time left on a sentence, you can't get released early through this program. And also, if the Saudi government believes that when you leave prison, you'll be involved in violence, they won't release you from jail. So there's some obvious concerns about this, especially because, you know, of the 3,000 or 3,200 people believed to be under detention in Saudi Arabia, a great number of these people have never appeared before a judge or have never been charged with crimes. And so that's one major concern in all of this. The Saudis talk about this program with a 80 to 90% success rate, and that would include the 20% failure rate, then would include everybody who chooses not to participate in this program, because you're given the option in prison whether or not you want to participate. Some people, especially those that are the most committed and the most hardcore, don't want anything to do with it. So it includes those people who refuse and those people who go through the program and fail. Of the roughly 3,000 people that have gone through the program, about 1,400, maybe 1,500 have been released. And of those, about 35 people have been rearrested. So that's about 2% recidivist rate, which is pretty good. Typically, you would want 5 years to look at a recidivist rate to get really solid data. And there could be a number of people who have been released through this program who have gotten, you know, into trouble or who are plotting things right now that just haven't been apprehended. So there are two different ways that this works. One is through a very short, you know, two-hour session where people have a one-on-one dialogue. By the end of one two-hour session, or maybe two or three, the detainee has realized the error of his ways and has recanted. The people who go through that route are usually people who are looking for a way to get out. These are people who were and got involved with extremists and didn't know it and then figured out and are looking for a way out. So maybe somebody asked you to paint a car or rent an apartment or something like that. As soon as you figured out who you're working with, you are looking for a way out. The other program is something called long study sessions. And these are classes. These are classes with about 20 students, and they go for about 6 weeks at a time. Students study 10 subjects, and there are a series of instructors. There are religious authorities and also psychologists and psychiatrists who teach the classes with them. So their classes about jihad, takfir, the hadith, but also about self-esteem and other things. At the end of the course, there's an exam. If you fail the exam, you take the course over again. So you go through another 6 weeks, and if you fail the exam, then you go through the course again. While this is going on, there's an aspect, and it gets into much more detail in the paper. In addition to the people who teach and dialogue, there's also a group of psychologists and social scientists who do research on who it is that is going through this program. And they do this in order to determine what kind of social support the government needs to provide these guys while they're in prison. The idea being that if you're in prison, you can't be earning a salary. You're not earning a salary. Who's going to be taking care of your family? So in addition to giving families stipends, they also help if you have children who need to get to school, parents who need to get to hospital, things like that. And this is done for a couple of reasons. One is to offset the hardship of being arrested. You know, the Saudis recognize that people have very long memories, and you remember who it is that took your loved one away. It's also done in an attempt to short-circuit further radicalization within families. So we can talk much more about rehab if people have more questions during the Q&A. The final part of this approach is what the Saudis call aftercare. These are really reintegration programs. So these are programs that take guys that have gone through rehabilitation and help them either get jobs, settle back in with their families. And a lot of this is done through social support. So some of the things I was mentioning earlier, if it's paying for weddings, if it's getting cars, a lot of those financial material things that people often report about when they talk about the Saudi program. In addition, there are also training courses. There are courses to help people when they leave prison have jobs. There are programs to help you get money to start up a new job. And much of the reintegration programs take place outside of prison. So there's a very different approach to being inside a typical prison with bars and concrete and barbed wire to go into a rehabilitation facility, which is much more like a halfway house. It's residential treatment. It's communal living. And the whole time, while security detainees are inside one of these rehabilitation centers, the staff, so the religious scholars and the doctors, live with them. So they're constantly evaluating and deciding when it is that someone has made a genuine recantation or has moved to recognize that they won't do it again when they get released. A lot of these programs are geared towards preventing recidivism, so making sure that people who are headed down one path don't go further. It's also another important aspect of this has been about the reintegration of guys that come back from Guantanamo. And important in all of that is that from this point of view, everybody's a victim. You've been victimized because you were in Guantanamo. The government is victimized because of terrorism and violence. So it's how can you come back to the right path and how can the government help you get there? And I think I'll just say a couple last words, and that's, I think one of the important things about why the Saudi program is so critical to understanding is because the Saudi's been doing this for about the past 4 or so years. And in those years, the Saudi program has become sort of a de facto approach for how to run a counter-radicalization program or a de-radicalization program. It's the best funded, the longest running. And many other countries, when they're trying to implement something like this, naturally turn to the Saudis. And it's kind of very telling that what the American Marine Corps is doing in Iraq is based in part on the Saudi approach. And, you know, looking forward, the Yemeni government used to do something like this, and it's kind of very encouraging that hopefully they could try to do something like this again, better funded and with a lot of other caveats. But to help guys who are in Guantanamo get repatriated back to their home countries. So that's a very fast overview, and I'm sure that there are lots of questions, but I'll let Ambassador Daley say a few words.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Marina. To everybody else, thanks. It's a wonderful Monday morning here, and I'm sure you'd rather be out looking at some of the memorials or picnicking or be with your family, even though you'd have to have them take hooky from school, but there are not a lot more days like today available, so try and use them as best you can. And at a minimum, spend lunch at a cafe downtown today. So that's my one bit of advice for a guy who grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, graduated from St. John's College High School, which is up the street here from on Rock Creek Park and Military Road. Anybody here from the Saudi Embassy? Okay, good. Those things that we don't cover correctly, I expect a critique, if not formally, at least maybe informally later on. What I'd like to do is talk about how U.S. counterterrorism policy needs this type of soft diplomacy and soft actions to make the policy correct. The FARC in Colombia, non-religious. IRA in UK, non-religious. ETA in Spain, non-religious. Our focus is not against a religious organization. Our focus is against terror and terrorism. So portions of this discussion will gravitate towards Saudi Arabia and to Muslim and the Islamic religion. But it's terrorism across the board that the United States government and the United States people abhor. I'd like to start off with is the counterterrorism model. And if you just take a triangle like this, and that upper portion, the upper portion of the triangle, if you're all geometry majors, you know what I'm talking about. That little portion there, let's just nickname kill or capture. And that's done by intelligence services, by the military, and by law enforcement. And it's the exciting part of counterterrorism, and it's the part that gets everybody's interest. It's the part that movies are made of, books are written about, and TV shows have an endless life on a series program. For example, The Unit. It is in the Department of State is in support of that top portion of the triangle. In the scheme of things, it probably ought to be about 15% of the U.S. government's effort in the counterterrorism arena. It goes out and gets leaders of enemy organizations and either captures them or it kills them. That's got a lot of powerful U.S. history tied to it. It's decisive. It's evident. And it kind of scratches our itch for results. But it doesn't stop terrorism. All it does is buy us some time. Now, let's go down the next portion of that triangle, the center portion. That's what we call the disrupt part. And there's nine areas that we want to disrupt, and we want to disrupt terrorist organizations. So we want to disrupt recruiting, travel, communications, logistics, training, finances, ideology. And an important part of that is, not necessarily tied to the term disrupt, but equally important, implement counterterrorism legislation in that country. And every country in the world that deals with terrorism as a criminal activity walks to the ball game and only plays on one half of the field. Because terrorism is a step higher than criminality. Terrorism goes into the head of the terrorist. In criminality, they're only out for money. So criminal laws are fine for criminality. But if you want criminal laws to apply to terrorists, terrorists will get away most of the time because what they're doing is far more severe and far more intensive and far more results-oriented to the demise of good people than criminality. That disrupt portion there, it's about 15 or 20% of our effort. It's led, once again, by the intelligence services, departments of defense, departments of interior, with the foreign ministries in one way, shape, form, or another around the world in a support role. But it's disrupting terrorist networks and organizations. Then the bottom of that triangle, big old fat bottom, the base, the foundation, that which allows the triangle to stand. That really is the most important part of terrorism. It's the most important part of counterterrorism. Social inequity. Economic distribution of resources, lack of political integration, religious persecution, ideological extremism. Those five things, every terrorist that blows a suicide vest or drives a vehicle or takes a sniper shot or blows a grenade falls in one of those five categories, and usually a combination. Now, in this big triangle, kill or capture, disrupt, and let's just say, for want of another word, those areas that the terrorists want to exploit, let's say hearts and minds is the bottom, the top two just buy us time to fix the bottom. If you never fix the bottom, you'll never end terrorism. They'll just keep coming at you. So tops one and two, about 15 to 20%, total about 40%. The bottom of that triangle level of effort ought to be about 60%. It takes a lot of time to implement. It takes some resources, considerable resources to implement. And frankly, it's not macho. It's not gunslinging down Main Street of Abilene, Texas. It doesn't pizzazz the people on TV shows, on the movies, or in books. But it's the essence of counterterrorism. You take away those areas that the individuals think they're being exploited in. You take away the recruiting for terrorism. Okay, now let's talk about the standard process that a terrorist goes through mentally from being a public citizen on the street all the way up to being becoming a core leader in terrorism. We've got about four tiers. Each of the tiers have two or three steps inside. Mainstream population and aggrieved individuals, probably 98% of the organization that you're going after. Mainstream population, aggrieved individuals. That can be resolved through just plain good public diplomacy and good political actions. But for some reason, they become alienated and aggravated individuals, or radicalized individuals, or trained and or indoctrinated radicals. These folks can only be won over now if grievances are answered. And it requires some type of ideological attack, I say attack, or effort to win these folks back. But we find out that most grievances turn out to be intractable. A dominant country not prepared to give away to open press. Centralized economic system not prepared to go to free trade. So those grievances will be intractable because that government won't want to meet them. Then we jump up to the next level of the extremist conveyor belt, tier two, local insurgent fighters and regional terrorist cells. They have to be countered through integrated actions, starting with persuasion, ending with criminality. Then finally, you got the top tier. They support networks, they're active terrorist cells, and they are core leadership. These folks are beyond conversion, beyond persuasion, and must be destroyed or captured or killed. They are the ones who lead this process of terror that we have to get at, but they're also replaceable by individuals coming from the bottom. So where does this, now that we've talked about the counterterrorism model and I've talked about how people become terrorists, where does Saudi Arabia's effort to fit in? Number one, they've had some radicals. They've had support cells. They've had interior people who should come up from within the system, be dedicated, loyal Saudi Arabian citizens who've turned against it, whether it's the government, the economic situation, or the social lifestyle that they're in. They have come to the top of the extremist conveyor belt. Saudi Arabia figured it out sometime between 02 and 04. They went about kill or capture. They followed this model like it was written in Riyadh. They went after the leaders and got a lot of them. Then they went after the cells and the networks and were very successful there. Every once in a while, there's an indicator, though, they weren't quite as successful with the attack on the energy infrastructure. or an attack on, as I recall, a U.S. Defense facility. But fundamentally, they had moved out using this type of process. And then finally on the bottom, where they want to take the hearts and minds, they very aggressively moved out themselves. And frankly, were pretty darn successful. So the Saudis fit into this triangle mode pretty darn well. Now, a couple things about the Saudi method. First of all, there's three steps you have to understand as a nation before you move into what Chris was talking about. First of all, you've got to acknowledge you've got a problem. Second of all, you've got to acknowledge and start thinking about and attempt to implement a country-specific solution to your problem. Now, the Saudis did it completely different than maybe Western country. The Saudis view their extremists not as criminals, but as victims. And as a result, there should be a support structure to bring this victim back into mainstream. And their acknowledgement of the victimization process is so powerful that a Saudi government leader will call up a mom and dad whose son has just been picked up or daughter just been picked up doing terrorist-like activities and say, we found the victim. We want to help him. We need your help also. We think we can be successful. It's not, say, who's his name? Just went in the slammer. You'll be able to see him 6 weeks from now, and it goes before court. Court will crush him next time you see him or her, or 7 years from now. So in my steps there, the top one was the country's got to realize it's got a problem. Second one is country needs to apply a country culturally sensitive and aware solution to the problem. The third is country's got to have resources. This doesn't come easy. A lot of this requires a modification of your corrections facility. Another part of it requires a huge amount of social work. And the last step in this process is the key factor. You got to persist. It can't be a happen shot in the dark. We're going to just do this for 4 or 5 years, see how it works. It's got to take on for quite a while. So Saudi Arabia did their process. There are a couple other out there that have some similar attributes. Task Force 131, the U.S. military coalition forces under Major General Doug Stone in Iraq, has captured some Saudi techniques and Singaporean techniques. Southeast Asia countries realize that this is important, the hearts and minds. They've gone about some of their steps using some of these techniques. But remember, you got to recognize you got a problem. Use a cultural or sensitive or approach to solving it that has that country's fingerprints on, then resources and time. We're checking to see how much time, because Saudi is probably the first one in place that's gone the longest with the most diligence. My closing comment is that when I was there, I had a chance to visit with Assistant Interior Minister Mohammed bin Nayef. I specifically asked about this program. He allowed me to get briefed by a couple of his experts. It was very informative and very helpful. Some of the statistics they tossed out verbally, and they weren't present in a written manner, was at that point they had about 3,000 people involved in the process, that they had just released about 700, that of the 700, about 90 showed some levels of more intense supervision, closer supervision, and would not at that time be viewed as full success stories, but they were not readmitted back into the system. They were allowed to continue on the outside. That's pretty old information. That's about a year and a half old information. So it looks like the Saudis have done it the right way. So I close my portion and welcome any questions from the team here and turn it back over to Marina. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think there are going to be a lot of questions. I hope there are going to be a lot of questions. I have some myself, but I will not ask them at this point. Please identify yourself when you ask a question, particularly since, as I said, we don't have a participants list. So the floor is open. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Yasmina. I'm Sorry, my name is Yasmin Al-Amri from the Saudi Press Agency. I actually just had a couple of questions. In your, I guess, assessment of the rehabilitation programs and all the different programs that Saudi Arabia has, do you see that there's a discrepancy between the willingness of young people versus older people in actually wanting to go through the programs and be rehabilitated and to, I guess, seek a life outside of pursuing terrorism? And the other question is, it seems as if, and I know for the American prison system, sometimes people that are marginalized kind of want to become part of the system so that the government will give them some of these, I guess, like pay attention to them and give them special treatment. Do you see that at all, kind of an attraction to just get the benefit of the government and buying them cars or you know, giving them housing? Thank you.
Right, thank you. On the age question, I think something that comes out is that in order for people to go through the program and for it to be successful, in order for you to make a sincere sort of turn, I think you need to have recognized that you have something to lose. So a lot of times they find that if it's kids, you know, until you've had a serious run-in with the police or until you've really recognized that there's some way for things to go really, really bad, you won't take advantage of the opportunity to change things. Something else with respect to age is that a lot of the things that the Saudis do in terms of encouraging you to get married, encouraging you to have kids, get a job, as soon as you find that there are other things for you to lose, then there's a big incentive for you not to get in trouble again. At the same time, you won't be able to get in trouble if you have family obligations and jobs and other things. On the second part of your question, I mean, I think it's something that the Saudis get criticized an awful lot about, and I think you read this in the Saudi press, it kind of comes in waves, this criticism that says, you know, my kids haven't done anything wrong, and they're not getting cars, or they're not getting jobs, right? Why are we only rewarding people who have engaged in bad behavior, right? I mean, I think, you know, somebody could probably make an argument that, you know, if the Saudi government would just cut a check to every citizen, maybe you could do more. But I think, you know, until you go through the bad part of incarceration and being in prison, I think there's a big inducement to wanting to cooperate, right? So I would think, and personally, I think it's very hard to believe that there are many people who would want to go to jail for a couple of years to get a free car or would want to benefit from these programs. So I don't really think that happens very often.
If I could just make a couple comments. It's easier to build an army with youngsters than it is to build one with a bunch of older folks. They're more manipulative, more manipulated. They're easier to convince. They have gang philosophy more so than more senior and deliberate folks. So I think we'll find it's the younger folks that are easier to get into the process of radicalization, and it's probably easier to get the older folks out of the process of radicalization. I don't have any statistics. I just would like to apply human nature. The second is that folks come to this de-radicalization process with different goals and different expectations. Material wealth will certainly be part of it, allows them to integrate back into the process, allows them to be members of society, compels them to want to maintain that. Emotional wealth by virtue of marriage with someone that they love or someone that their parents have arranged that they realize later on they love is an equal part. So all of those subsequent tools, and then, of course, the counseling, are valuable. And some individuals may need a little bit more than others, but my understanding is that when it really gets down to the important part, it's that transition that they make ideologically, and then the other tools allow them to build on the transition and become more and more and more successful, which is integration back into society.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Yes. Angel Rabasa with the Rand Corporation. And my question is for Mr. Busek. And it has to do with, it's a two-part question. First, I'd like to ask you if you could say a bit more about the philosophy of the Saudi de-radicalization program, that one could see two very distinct approaches to de-radicalization. One is changing behavior where you don't try to change the underlying worldview, but only the violence, so that you could be told that jihad is not wrong, it's a perfectly good concept, it's just wrong in this particular country because it's not occupied by outsiders and it's a Muslim government and so forth. And the other is where you do try to change the underlying assumptions. For example, what the Quillian Foundation is doing in the United Kingdom. Could you tell me where in this spectrum does the Saudi program fall? And second, if you could tell us what you think about the rate of recidivism in Saudi Arabia. I mean, that Saudis claim very low levels of recidivism. We know that in Yemen, that has a similar problems, the rates of recidivism are very high. Whether we can trust the numbers and whether there's any independent verification that the program does in fact succeed in removing people from violent militancy. Thank you.
Those are two great questions. I think I'll start with the first one. And I really appreciate you asking this because it gives me an opportunity to talk a little bit more about, you know, the program philosophy. And the idea behind this, it comes from a couple of different places. One is that I think, you know, the Saudi government looks at this in terms of benevolence, right? This isn't about retribution. This isn't about punishment. It's about giving you a second opportunity to get it right. So the guys who run the program, you know, the doctors and the sheikhs and things like that, they assert that the people who go through the program got a corrupted understanding of Islam, right? So they look at this in terms of they need to remove certain understandings and they need to reintroduce new teachings. And I mean, that raises some really interesting questions. And I think it's very interesting that for Saudi Arabia, and I think the ambassador sort of referenced this, that this is a very Saudi solution to a very Saudi problem, right? And this uses really Saudi traditional techniques for conflict resolution and conflict management. This is all about co-optation and bringing people into the fold. It's also about spreading responsibility across lots of different shoulders. So when someone gets released, you know, your family is told that you're responsible. At the same time, you know, there are a lot of kind of traits and characteristics of Wahhabism that meld really nicely with what this program tries to do, right? It's about recognition of authority. It's about obedience to authority. It's about loyalty. And these are things that really get stressed over and over again in the program. So when you're talking about whether or not things are permitted, I mean, this program is geared only at Saudi Arabia. It's only about security and stability inside the kingdom, right? They don't talk about Iraq in terms of whether or not Iraq is legitimate, right? And they won't talk about Palestine or Israel and whether or not it's legitimate or whether or not you can go fight. What they'll say is, you know, that the rules don't permit you to go. And because you need to listen to a religious authority, they're the ones who can make these decisions for you. And then they'll go through, you know, what the rules for jihad are and try to teach these guys how it isn't permissible. You know, and I've had some of the clerics, you know, say that if this was legitimate, then we'd participate in it too. But it's not, and we're going to show you why it's not permissible. The second point about recidivist rates, I mean, I think, you know, it would be great for this, the kind of research that really needs to be done on this is to look at, you would really need to do, I think, like a big longitudinal study to say who was arrested, how long were you in prison before you entered this program, what charges were you arrested on, how long had you been in the program before you were released, how long were you released. I mean, there are a lot of things I think would help us understand who it is that goes through this program. Within the spectrum of offenders, you know, there are the guys who are the most committed and they're the people who are the least committed, right? So the figures, I think, you know, they look really, really appealing in part because the people who have gone through the program are the easiest to rehabilitate, right? These are the ones who pose the least danger. At the same time, it's important to short-circuit the radicalization process to make sure that these guys don't go on to the next step or that their family members don't go on to the next step. You know, the Yemeni program, you know, the Yemenis started this, started doing something like this right after September 11th, and it was incredibly underfunded. You know, there's no money in Yemen to do very much of any kind of social programming, much less pay for psychological counseling and rehabilitation and things like that. The Yemeni program was designed to get prisoners to recognize the sovereignty of the Yemeni government, recognize that, you know, Yemen is an Islamic government, and to guarantee that these guys wouldn't get into trouble inside Yemen. Everything else, there is nothing. So you would be released, you'd be released from a Yemeni prison, and, you know, there's nothing to help you. There's no kind of social support or infrastructure. As opposed to the Saudi program, which is all about providing this social welfare system to help you stay out of trouble and make sure that you don't get in trouble again.
If I may, on the there is a bit of a challenge on the internal solutions that Saudi Arabia is providing its people and its own state security, and how does that impact on the external side? That's really, I think, what you're talking about, and that's the wrestling match that the U.S. government has. Best epitomized by charities. Everybody is in a religion. It's a key aspect of it to donate and to be charitable, and that's certainly not what we're attacking with regards to the Saudi Arabian government or other governments. It's the charity money that gets redirected to terrorist organizations. Saudi Arabia has done absolutely magnificent work, due diligence and all of the right things, and been very successful on controlling its charities internal to Saudi Arabia because they're focusing on the internal challenge for Saudi Arabia. Unfortunately, a lot of that money is funneled out through external charities, and the commission that was established in Saudi Arabia is focused on the internal aspects. We'd prefer to see them do it more so on the external aspects because there's large amounts of fundings, although we can't track it very well, that do go external, that have the potential to end up in terrorist organizations. So our question for the Saudi government is to establish both an internal and external commission that goes after both internal money and external money, which goes a little bit to the example of what you're asking. Is the solution a long-term solution internally for Saudi Arabia, or is it a long-term solution for the region? Right now, we see it primarily as the former. We'd like to see it move forward to the latter. And by the way, Yemen's a tough country to compare in these two different programs.
I think there was a report in the Yemen Times recently that the U.S. government was looking at, or even potentially starting to revisit with Yemen its rehab program. So to pick up on your point about developing country-specific solutions, if one of the problems with the Yemen program in the past was sort of lack of funding, a lack of really creating a robust, holistic solution, if there is more money that becomes available to Yemen, what would you envision that program, a successful Yemeni program, looking like, given the differences in Saudi society and Yemeni society?
Well, first of all, on that tier of four that I mentioned, it looks like the Yemenis realize that they probably need to go after the radicalization in their country. Tough because it's pretty tribal-oriented. But it looks like they've made that first step, although they made that first step way back post-coal bombing also. Second step is a Yemeni solution. I'm not sure what the solution would be. It would take some true Yemeni patriots to figure it out, Islamic leaders, cultural leaders, familial leaders, probably some outside sources also from across the Gulf and also with on the Arabian Peninsula. The third part's what you just talked about. Yes, the government, they've asked for the U.S. government had asked them to look at some type of rehabilitation, re-education program. They came back saying we might be able to do it with $5 million. Probably a good start, maybe not be enough money. I'm not sure where that is in the process of formal negotiations or formal discussions, but those in the informal world, those numbers have been passed around. Then, of course, it's got to stay. Remember, the fourth pillar was it's got to be continuous. So this is just a one-time shot. It's a, in my eyes, as you look at the kill or capture and the disrupt stuff, that the Yemenis are interested in the bottom portion of that triangle to go after hearts and minds to prevent troops to be individuals from becoming recruiters and going up that conveyor belt. Absolutely the right thing to do, and we should support it as best we can.
I think I put in my question for a moment, and then I take the other two. And this is a question for both the speakers. Whenever I listen to briefings about the Saudi program and listen to these explanations and so on, I come out with two very opposite reactions. On one side, this is an extremely, progressive, forward-looking, liberal, if I can use that that expression. Program is the best of what social science have taught us about rehabilitation, the way you reintegrate people and so on. The other side, and here I'm playing a bit of the devil's advocate, but there is also an element what we are doing. In fact, this is an incredibly authoritarian system. It's the attempt to reestablish one dogma, the government's dogma, and to use that dogma to fight a different one. In other words, you are fighting the extremist ideology with the official ideology, with the official Wahhabi ideology. And if we take seriously, and I'm not saying that I necessarily do, the arguments that have been set forth in this country when after 9/11, when it turned out that so many of the terrorists came from Saudi Arabia, the argument that was set forth was, well, it's the lack of democracy, it's the lack of choices, it's the frustrations that the political system engenders that lead to, that has led to participation. So the question is, on one hand, we seem to have this very progressive program of rehabilitating and reintegrating the terrorist, at least sort of the least committed, I would say, in the ranks of potential terrorists. On the other hand, we are perpetuating, this is a program that perpetuates some of those features of Saudi society that we have claimed lead to encourage terrorism. So I'd like you both to comment on this.
Well, I think you really hit to one of the central conundrums about looking at a program like this. On the one hand, it looks incredibly liberal, right? And it looks like what the Saudis are doing is very, very enlightened. And on a certain extent, I think it really is. You made this good point that many of the people who are responsible for creating and putting together this framework studied in this country 15, 20 years ago when a lot of these ideas were in vogue. On the other hand, the idea that that this reinforces a certain amount of authoritarianism, I think it's obviously it's a very paternalistic approach to addressing these issues. And I think the Saudis, I think they think about this in terms of what are the issues that motivate people to move on to the next step, and how can they short circuit this? And there are a lot of other things that go into this this kind of big strategy that don't get talked about much. If it's poverty reduction or if it's education reform and things like that, and I think the one way to kind of look at this program is that the Saudis have thought, where do we want our country to be 35 or so years down the road, and how can we get there? And one of the things that they've identified is to eliminate or to deter the support for violence, or why it would be okay for you to tacitly endorse these things. And I think that's kind of a big dilemma, not just for the Saudis, but for lots of other countries. And it seems that through some of the programs that the government can do, if it's through social welfare, if it's through education or prison restructuring, hopefully they can kind of move society in the direction that they want to get to. I hope that touches on it.
Well, that's the eternal question. How long does the United States support countries that aren't totally full, complete, uncompromising democratic nations? And I think what we have in the terrorist world, those first two things, the killer capture, the disrupt, those buy time for the bottom thing. It's the same situation we have here in Saudi Arabia. Controlling the terrorists internal to their borders needs to be done here and now. It's got the potential to shake the country to its foundation. Once that's back intact, once that security aspect is in place, the continuing nudging and the continuing external discussions and the continuing efforts for them to be more transparent, them being the Saudi government, be more transparent, to move towards a modified form of democracy, if you want for another word, to keep peace in the area, all of those will then become issues the United States continually talks about. But if terrorism unseats the government, that's a challenge that's far more difficult to fix than the gradual movement towards liberalization.
Senate Intelligence Committee, just wanted to touch on, Ambassador, you mentioned the lowest pillar, kind of the Hearts and Minds campaign, and the various issues that lead into that and support the underlying ideology for terrorism, social inequality, and so on. It seems that there's also another issue that should be mentioned, at least in this mix, is the worldwide opinion of the United States and the overall struggle on against terrorism, where our numbers haven't been probably where they should be for the last couple of years. But it seems that that kind of opposition to our activities in Iraq and Pakistan, and specifically I think after the bombing at the Marriott, I was in Pakistan. I was very interested to see the reaction was not a condemnation of the terrorist act as much on the part of kind of your on-the-street Pakistanis, but in some ways it was, well, this is a reaction to our government following America's war and so on and so forth. So it seems that that kind of opposition to U.S. policies plays a role in the underlying current that supports these individuals that then become more active. And it seems like this is an extremely good start to address some of the more active folks and try to walk them back. But with the worldwide opinion of the United States, specifically in parts of the Middle East, at such a low level, it seems that in some ways it's kind of treading against the stream. And until those numbers go up, you're going to face more and more people that go into terrorism, or at least as many as we're able to bring out through this program. So I wonder if you could address that as well. Thank you.
Well, it is a factor, but it's not a factor big enough to be in the bottom of the triangle. So that'd be my first answer. The second part is that you alluded there about the 20 September bombing of the Marriott. The Pakistani leadership has come out pretty hard. They're not tying it to the United States. They're tying it against extremists and terrorists in their country. And Zardari in particular is pretty outspoken. And that's important because it where they go, they will eventually have their people follow. Where we're probably not as good as we should be, and an excellent man has moved in that position to get us back on our feet, is in public diplomacy and public affairs and strategic communications. Undersecretary Jim Glassman in the State Department has just taken over. He does view himself as the supreme allied commander of the war on ideas, and what you've really talked about is how well the United States wrestles with the war on ideas. You know, we fought the Balkan War for Muslim-Islamic reason. We moved many, many, many troops out of Saudi Arabia. So that problem is behind us. We now put the number of wounded Iraqis or Afghanis who are more than likely Islamists, who clearly are innocent, who are clearly men, women, and children, into hospitals at a greater level of death and wounding than a coalition force. That fact doesn't get out in the street much. So we probably have a credibility and a popularity problem around the world, but we're working on it, and we have what I say is the right messages, the right situation, the right values, the right ethics to expound on that. We probably haven't done it as well as we'd like.
out of time. I'm Tyler Hoffman with the Office of the Middle East at the Commerce Department. Kind of getting down into the weeds a little bit, do we have any info on the education or social demographic of the Saudis who are in this program? Because it seems that Saudi is probably an outlier in what it seems U.S. policy has been towards addressing the social economic inequities, and that's what creates terrorism. Or leads people into an environment where they would support terrorist ideology. I'm just curious, are the Saudis that are in this program more educated than you would say the typical, say, Yemeni? I would think so. But where do they fall on this spectrum?
That's a great question. Yeah, typically, when you look at guys who got active with the QAP during the violence, you know, from 2003 to 2006 or so, right? I mean, they all, by and large, came from major urban areas, were middle class, were, you know, pretty well educated. When you look at the guys who have gone through the rehabilitation program, there have been two very large studies looking at this. And it's divided into people who were active in violence abroad and people who were active in violence domestically. So the people who are involved in violence domestically, who were active overseas, you know, typically, were in their 20s. They come from large families, you know, 7 to 15 siblings. Their parents are typically lower to, you know, middle, lower class, do not have very high education levels. A lot of the detainees were either students or in low-income jobs. Very interestingly, there's not a very high level of people who are in religious positions, so they weren't with the Matawa, they weren't sheikhs, things like that. The people who, you know, kind of followed a typical route to radicalization through books and tapes and things like that, where they ended up fighting, you know, and about a third of them ended up fighting abroad. And they went to Afghanistan, to the Balkans, to Somalia, places like that. Most of these guys were found to not have a very successful religious education. All education in Saudi Arabia is religious, but didn't have a very thorough religious education. Interestingly, of these guys that have gone through rehabilitation, about 25% of them have criminal records, and of that, about half of those have been arrested on drug charges. So there's these guys who get involved in violence abroad usually get motivated through either the writings or the audio tapes or videotapes of theorists, right? Guys who talk about, you know, the ideological justifications for why you should get involved. The people who get involved in violence domestically, usually this is a very different group, right? Typically, they come from abusive homes. This is what the Saudi government research argues. Typically, the fathers are much older. Same with the education levels as the first group. Usually there are multiple wives in these families. So one of the arguments that the Saudis said to help explain why these guys get active is that if you get less attention at home, if nobody's paying attention to what you're doing, you're more likely to end up in trouble. There's a higher arrest record with these guys, more and more involved in street fighting, things like that. I don't really know if you can make a comparison with the guys who go through the program in Saudi Arabia with those who go through in Yemen. I don't think I'd be hesitant to make that kind of a comparison.
I think I have two more questions. I'll take them, unless there are more. I'll take them together, and then we can wrap up. So we had one here and one back there.
Thank you. I'm Todd Rosenblum, also on the Senate Intelligence Committee. And General, we had you before the committee on your on SOCOM human programs a few years back. Your hair's a little bit longer now that you're out of uniform, I'll say. I want to ask a difficult question, you know, potentially sort of awkward, but I think it always needs to be asked in these kind of forums. I'm quite interested in responses perhaps from all three. And I apologize if you went over this somewhat at the beginning. I believe you did talk about underlying building blocks, but I want to ask it again, and maybe it's different than it was presented before. How much, when we talk about radicalization, leading to violent extremism, people prepared to commit acts of violence. How much of this is an underlying ideology of intolerance, sort of a religious, and I don't want to say just cultural, a religious sort of teaching of distrust of others, sort of a feeling of persecution, and also a lack of mainstream clerical condemnation of radicalism. I know I'm familiar with the Saudi program as well, and the Yemeni program, and the official ulama is coming out and saying they're opposed to sort of takfiriism, the most extreme form. But at the level before you get to that point, we see in lots of religious faiths around the world there's different degradations. Are we seeing enough in your views a condemnation of intolerance and distrust of outsiders? Because, sir, with all due respect, on the public diplomacy side, I mean, this is a perennial. It goes back, you know, ages and ages and ages, and we need to do a better job explaining ourselves of what we do, the positives, and we do a tremendous amount of positives. But I just wonder if the real origin of public diplomacy here is coming from the clerical community in Islam, much more from the U.S. explaining itself in terms of radicalism. And then I just finally wrap up this very long-winded question with the notion of we don't seem to have this same problem here in the U.S., the U.S. Muslim community, the sense of alienation, the drive toward radicalization of sort of extremism. I know the prison population issue, there's issues there, but I think that's tied to lots and lots of different variables. But by and large, the Muslim community in the U.S., it doesn't seem to have the same issues we see in Europe or we see really throughout the Arab world.
Rebecca Wall. I'm with the Office of the Coordinator for Reconstruction and Stabilization in the State Department. And I was just curious, obviously we're looking at this situation because we want to see if it's something that can be replicated in other countries. And I was wondering if you could talk about the difference between a program like this in a steady state that has a government versus conflict zones and what the U.S.'s role is to play in these two different situations versus advocating for the government to do something or us actually doing something, and whose role in the government that is, whether it's State Department, Defense Department. Thank you.
We conclude on two pretty hefty questions.
I think on the ideology of intolerance, which I think is what I wrote that down. I think, you know, the way that the Saudis look at this is that there need to be four components for violence to go to the next step, right? You need to have manpower, you need to have money, and you need to have material, you need to have a mindset. I think without ideology, like, you don't advance to the next level, right? I think that's really pretty well understood. I think there are a lot of other factors, I think, in Saudi Arabia which contribute to the radicalization process. I mean, it's an incredibly xenophobic place. It's a place without much experience dealing with outsiders. Right? I mean, for the longest time, the only foreigners who ever came to Saudi Arabia were Muslim pilgrims. Right? So there's never any interaction with other people. And I think, you know, one of the things that the Saudis are trying to do through this program and through others is trying to reduce the value of that ideology. And I think it can be pretty powerful when you get former regime critics to be involved in a program like this, right? I mean, I think you know, there's been a lot in the press lately about different people, if it's Salman Alauda or others who have come out to condemn violence. And I think, you know, those things are incredibly powerful, I think, especially in Saudi Arabia. Whether or not this program is replicable, I think that was your question, right? There are things in this program that, while you couldn't use this like a cookie cutter to pick it up and apply it other places, there are things that work here in Saudi Arabia the same way that they will work trying to demobilize leftist guerrillas in Latin America or you know, neo-Nazi skinheads, right? I mean, it's about giving people alternatives, a lot of it about education. A key factor in the success of any one of these programs is that it's not just the individual who gets treated, it's someone's entire social network. So while I think, you know, the Saudis are able to use a lot of traditional cultural mores and notions of honor and things like that to really influence behavior, I mean, it's a lot of co-optation and coercion. There are things that you can learn from this program and apply at other places. I think I'll stop there.
To answer my sissy friend there, was it sissy or hissy? The involvement of clerical imams, religious leaders, and scholars is very important. They teach as best they can what they view as the interpretation of the religion. That appropriate teaching, if you listen to other scholars, is enough ammunition to start dispelling and debunking the challenges that we have. Because in most cases, radicals have been exposed to readings and teachings that are twisted in the particular religion. It's probably not going as fast as we'd like, but it's taking off. It's moving along. From the long, long time ago fatwa that the Grand Mufti of Madrid gave almost 4 years ago to the year and a half ago fatwa that the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia has presented, that Yemen said we follow what Saudi Arabia does. So it's probably not here and now like a typical American would want, but it's all moving the right direction. I submit to you, it's probably moving faster than some of the religions that people are members of here if they had the same predicament. Problem with it all is, though, that religious awareness and awakening in most cases is for the survival of the state. It doesn't necessarily get outside the state. And this is goes back to your question earlier, sir. The United States and other nations, particularly the nations that are being affected by radicalism that comes out of their state and another, a regional perspective of trying to shut this down or this thought process down is more valuable and necessary as the next step. We're working on the initial step when you go to the next step. That's clean up the first part. The second part you'd said was about the United States' image around the world. Whole different issue. That is public diplomacy. That's the definition of public diplomacy. Like I had said earlier, you were here for part of that. We got some work in front of us there. A lot of good success stories, but maybe some that need to be recaptured and restated in as many different and unique manners as we can. And I didn't follow the last question from the lady at John Herb's office. Could you say it again, please?
I'm just curious what the U.S.'s role could be in any potential application of this in other countries and how that differs from a steady state to a complex state versus using diplomacy to advocate countries to implement this versus what you're talking about in Iraq, which is specifically our troops implementing something else.
Back to the thought process is that a U.S. solution is clearly a non-starter. It's got to be a host nation's own solution. So in Iraq, we kind of came in there with the heavy, and we didn't have reliable information from even our internal sources, whether it was Kurds or disaffected Shiite or whatnot. So we probably had a rough time trying to figure out how to close that gap from fighting to nation building in that area right in there that's historically, in both Afghanistan and Iraq, it hasn't been quite filled. Goes back to the thought process is that we put millions and billions of dollars into our defense budget that plots the bottom of the ocean for submarines. That's a physical intelligence science. What we don't spend billions and billions of dollars on is the human terrain intelligence that's so important before you go into a country. So if we had had a bottom of an ocean's worth of intelligence done on all of the tribes in Afghanistan and the cultural differences, and the same with Iraq, we probably would have been much further along in the awareness of how to work with them or how to pit them against one another. We're not quite there yet, because that's a soft science, and we deal kind of in our hard science. A bunch of companies are trying to move towards that human terrain issue. A bunch of organizations inside the Department of, inside the U.S. government trying to move towards that terrain side there. We've got a little bit of work. It's going to cost some money, but that is the direction, one of the directions we need to go as we move towards the, what we could say is the counterinsurgency challenge that faces the United States.
Time, so, and we all have to go back to work. So I'd like to thank you for coming here, and please help me thank the two speakers.